My name is Linda Komaroff, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here tonight. I think everyone knows why they're here, right? But just in case. And maybe we can have the lights down a little bit, please. So I'm going to play two roles here. I'm going to introduce the program, and then I'm also going to speak. And so there'll be two of me, basically. So rather than introduce each of the speakers in turn, I'm going to introduce everybody now. And the format will be that everyone's going to make a short-ish presentation, 15, 20 minutes-ish. And then, as time allows, we'll all come up front and have a short discussion. And then afterwards, we'll have a reception in the garden that's just behind the auditorium where we can continue the discussion. And it's really exciting to see this many people interested in collecting modern and contemporary Middle East art. And I hope after tonight, there'll be people who want to go out and seriously collect modern and contemporary Middle East art. So the first speaker is me. I don't have to introduce me. The second one is Houman Sarshar. The third is Roxanne Zand, and the fourth is Rebecca Morse, my colleague here at LAFMA. And you can see the program as a slide. So the nice thing about being both the one who does the introduction and a speaker is I'm not going to hold a little sign up for me when I have only 5 minutes left. I will hopefully, however, sort of stick to the allotted time. And I'm going to read something I don't normally do, but if I was just going to talk, I would really take forever. So I'll get started. So I used to believe there was no connection between the contemporary art world and Islamic art. In graduate school, I was taught that there was no fixed date for the beginnings of Islamic art, sometime during the first century of the Islamic era, but there was definitely an end date, about 1900, when art of the Middle East either was overwhelmed by the influence of Western art or reduced to crafts-like reproductions of earlier classical work. I do not know why it took me so long to question the idea of an end date, or at least to see it as something other or less than an absolute. Perhaps it's just that I know a little more than I used to, but I have come to take a longer view of history, and one that may ask more questions than it answers. My awakening to the notion that the parameters of Islamic art could be expanded to embrace contemporary art from the Middle East is therefore comparatively recent. To reconcile this fact that over the last decade I have helped form a collection of contemporary Middle East art at LACMA that now numbers over 300 works requires a little explaining, which I'll do. When I first arrived at LACMA 20 years ago, right out of high school, of course, it was expressly to be the curator in charge of the Islamic art collection, which I've had the fortunate opportunity to reshape and expand through various acquisitions, so that it is now twice the size it was and is a far more comprehensive collection, even now including, an 18th century Damascus room, of which I am inordinately proud. But this is not what propelled me over the contemporary threshold. My epiphany, and it truly was an epiphany, came as a direct result of an exhibition I saw at the British Museum in 2000, Word into Art, organized by my colleague in Islamic art there, Venetia Porter. This landmark exhibition focused on calligraphy and demonstrated how artists today use this classic Islamic art form, but in a contemporary manner and often in materials other than ink and paper. I was startled by the revelation that the art I loved was not in fact dead, but lived on, sharing the same DNA with historical Islamic art. For instance, the use of writing in the Arabic alphabet as a means of communication and decoration, brilliant color, geometric ornament, and a superb balance between design and form. And so in 2006, with the blessing of LACMA's director Michael Govan, but without a budget, I began to acquire contemporary art for my department. I was given this expanded portfolio to provide a modern-day face to our Islamic art collection, demonstrating the deep connection between past and present, which is at the heart of any encyclopedic art museum. Of equal concern, however, and quite apart from our historical collection, is how the works signal the virtuosity and creativity of artists from the Middle East and diasporic communities. From what I saw at the British Museum and then at LACMA, this type of art excites visitors, in part perhaps because though readily recognizable as contemporary, as perhaps you can see here in our old Islamic art galleries, the print of the letter Kaf, it looks quite different. And sadly, but importantly, it engages an audience because it is unexpected. Nowadays, the Middle East has become best known for things other than the contemplative beauty of art. With contemporary art, as compared with historical Islamic art, the connection for our audience is more immediate, the place names more relevant, and ultimately, I hope, the dismal reports and blur of media images somehow more real. Among the first artists I brought into the collection was the Iranian photographer Shadi Gaderian. These intriguingly anachronistic photos from a series of 33 portraits, all of them at LACMA, and inspired by the studio portraiture first introduced to Iran in the late 19th century under the Qajar dynasty. In order to recreate the earlier setting, Gaderian employed painted backdrops and dressed her models in vintage clothes to emulate the fashion of the day, headscarves and short skirts worn over baggy trousers, as well as thick black eyebrows. She added modern elements to these traditional scenes, such as the Pepsi can, which I think you can see here. These are enormously appealing images, in part because it is easy to appreciate the artist's intent. She has said of her work, my pictures became a mirror reflecting how I felt. We are stuck between tradition and modernity, end quote. Initially, my acquisitions were mainly restricted to photography and other print media. In addition to integrating contemporary works within the historical installation, I took over an unused space, basically an elevator lobby adjacent to the Islamic art galleries, where I began to have small dedicated installations of contemporary Middle East art. When no one here objected to my co-opting this space, I had the walls recovered with drywall to make it easy to install other media. By this time, 2013, my range of acquisitions had expanded to include video, soon followed by neon and 3D works. Here, for example, is Hassan Hajjaj's My Rock Stars of 2012, a three-channel video projecting 9 separately filmed performances by an international array of musicians, Hassan Hajjaj's own rock stars. As each performs, the other becomes the audience. Projected life-size, the video was installed, obviously opposite a bank of elevators. It was enormously pleasurable watching the faces of visitors, generally with expressions of wonderment and happy surprise as the elevator doors opened onto the performance and they got out. As visitors turned the corner to enter the Islamic art galleries to view the historical collection, it seemed to me they had a different level of expectation and engagement. In 2015, with the core of our historical Islamic collection on tour in Chile and then Mexico, we were able to redo the galleries, to tear out the very old cases and repaint everything and install the first of a two-part, two-year exhibition devoted to our contemporary Middle East collection. This is the second part from 2016. Like the first, it included dedicated spaces for videos, and here we are back in the first. So, for example, we showed this wonderful dual projection video by the late Farideh Lashai, which references the genre of cabaret or chauffeur-nous films, mainly from the 1960s and 70s, which we installed, as the artist had wanted, with tables and chairs so that the visitors could feel themselves to be part of the cabaret experience. And here from the second exhibition, a single-channel video from the 2012 series Rustam in Wonderland. Rustam, of course, is the great hero of the Shahnameh, the Iranian national epic, the Book of Kings. In this animated video, Rustam is transplanted to the 21st century, where he struggles with the sometimes farcical and often extreme contradictions of everyday life in the Islamic Republic of Iran. We have one last installation in this space, this one dedicated to the Saudi artist Abdel Nasser Haram, which also includes 2 works from our collection, one of them on the left. After that, these galleries will close for good, followed by the entire building and then nearly all buildings at LACMA in preparation for a new building. That gives me about 5 years to dream about and plan for a new larger gallery where I can choose to integrate the historical and contemporary collections or exhibit them separately. In the remaining time, I would like to give an expanded idea of works in the collection and my own ideas about the juxtaposition between past and present. This photograph is among the most powerful and appealing images from Shireen Nishat's monumental 1996 series, Women of Allah, which portrays chador-clad Iranian women often posed with rifle or gun in a provocative manner, their exposed body parts inscribed with text in black ink. Here, the Persian text is by the poet Tahireh Safarzadeh, in which she addresses her brothers in the revolution, asking if she can participate. The use of poetic inscriptions, which relate to and further enhance the inherent meaning of the object, has a long history in Iranian art. These stills are from Mona Khatoum's 1988 video, Measures of Distance. Again, writing, this time in Arabic, explicates the imagery. The artist's mother in the shower is covered only by the text of her letters to her daughter, which are read aloud in English. This work of art captures something truly universal. It's an intensely emotional, intimate, and physically palpable portrait of a mother-daughter relationship, filled with longing but undiminished by distance. Calligraphy, of course, remains an art form that can be practiced outside the context of a manuscript, as in monumental inscriptions or in smaller scale works that could be framed and hung on the wall. Here are works by Saudi artists Luwa Al-Hamoud and Nasser Asalam, both of whom study traditional calligraphy. Each has moved beyond to create a dynamic contemporary art form. Asalam, as here, has developed a unique approach to writing in which he focuses on the words and their meaning, medium, and aesthetic. For example, the three-dimensional calligraphy rendered in square Kufic, the turquoise one, which he cleverly transforms into a maze using the namesake Quranic verse, "Whoever obeys Allah, he will make for him a way out." The calligraphic composition not only renders the words of the verse, but visually recreates its meaning. In the infinity box, he uses neon to render the word Allah, which through the use of mirrors creates an optical illusion, visually substantiating the belief in the infinite nature of God. Once Turkey's best-known contemporary artist, Borhan Doğancı, was inspired by Islamic calligraphy in this beautiful pair of abstract compositions from the 1980s, in which bright, intensely curvilinear form seem to burst forth from flat, solid colored backgrounds. Moving away from calligraphy and toward abstraction and figuration, also key features of Islamic art, is Susan Hafuna's Woman Behind Mashrabiya. Here, largely obscured by the deep cast shadows of the intricately carved mashrabiya or window screen, we see, barely, a woman in full hijab. The tensely structured tectonics of light and shadow give the photograph its strength. But it is the image's beguiling ambiguity and our own complex reactions to it that make it an exceptional work of art. One of the things that first attracted me to the photograph was its obvious link with this piece from a late Ottoman-era Egyptian mashrabiya in our historical collection. Continuing with the theme of mashrabiya, Egyptian-born and Los Angeles-based Shireen Girgis here continues her hallmark practice of using hand-cut paper embedded with paint, gold powder, and gold relief to depict the trio of windows, again emulating the carved window screens of Cairo. In the large-scale sculpture at right, by the same artist, the carved wood mashrabiya was likewise a source of inspiration for Girgis. Dia Azawi is an artist whose work spans the 1960s up to the present, establishing a dialogue between modern and contemporary. A pioneer of Iraqi modern art, Azawi is perhaps best known for his powerfully evocative work in the Tate in London, titled Massacre at Sabra and Shatila, depicting the slaughter of Palestinian refugees in southern Beirut in 1982. But our price range for now restricts us to the artist's prints. So, for example, the untitled etching at left with its bound figure and dove, which relates to Azawi's larger scale works. The lithograph at right, with its abstracted image of a hawk, has to do with the transplanting of the early Islamic Umayyad dynasty from Syria to Spain, as referenced in the poem quoted at right. The bird of prey also reminds us of the significance of falconry, a theme often repeated in Islamic art, as in this Ottoman album painting in our collection, which helps to suggest a comparable composition in Azawi's print, and relates to these photographs by Tufik Behum, which are in part a clever take on the large photographs of the emirs and sheikhs of the Gulf states, whose oversized portraits are a common sight in most public buildings. And as the artist said, they're meant to, it's meant to reflect that they're blind and haughty. Many of our most recent acquisitions are related to LACMA's upcoming exhibition planned for spring 2018, which will combine my interests in historical Islamic art and contemporary Middle East art. Entitled In the Fields of Empty Days, the Intersection of Past and Present in Iranian Art, the exhibition takes as its theme the continuous and inescapable presence of the past in Iranian society. It will include 16th century and later Persian manuscript illustration, 19th century photography and painting, but it focuses on the period from the early 1970s up to the present day. So, for example, as here, we have acquired a number of photographs from the period just before and during the 1979 revolution by the most famous photographers, and these will be used in the exhibition to graphically remind exhibition visitors of this key moment of rupture in Iranian society. Kaveh Golestan series, Az Divodad, or Of Demon and Beast, of which LACMA has 10 works, is comprised of innovative and striking images shot in Polaroid by moving collaged fragments in front of an open shutter from a single lens reflex camera or lens. The collages create powerful visions of anthropomorphic lizard-headed kings and leonine army officers set against natural and architectural backgrounds, referencing both the 1970s and the late Qajar era. These works, which represent the satirical manipulation of historical figures, most notably members of the Qajar royal family, have prompted a new generation of artists to use images of former kings as a means of questioning and critiquing their own present-day non-royal leaders. Perhaps the best example of this is the series Underground, focusing on the reign and person of Nasser al-Din Shah by Siamak Felizadeh, which we acquired in 2016. As the lessons of history have shown and as the artist subtly suggests, and there is the artist, part of the great tragedy of Nasser al-Din Shah's reign is that the same types of mistakes were repeated under his successors, royal and otherwise. Finally, two of our latest acquisitions both reference the Shahnameh, the Iranian national epic. The inherent nationalism of the text here is something Shirina Shah brings forward to the present in her 2012 series, The Book of Kings, using portraits of friends and acquaintances with their hands crossed diagonally over their hearts to depict patriots, and a smaller group of villains, represented here, by full-length male portraits with battle scenes from the Shahnameh covering their bare upper torsos like tattoos. Yasmin Sinai is a sculptor little known outside of Iran. Here she reinterprets the mythological story of a great woman warrior in the Shahnameh. Indeed, Ghorda Farid is the only woman warrior in the text. Sinai extracts and visualizes her stories for a contemporary audience, in part as a reminder of the significant role women have played and continue to play in Iran. And in keeping with that, the two faces of Ghorda Farid, the mounted warrior and the puppet head, are self-portraits of the artist, again showing this intersection between past and present. So you can see the artist on the left, and I know several of you were with me when I met her, and I'm going to cut myself off here and thank you. And before I turn the podium over to our next speaker, I wanted to thank Roshi Rahmane of Advocacy Arts, or sorry, Advogartsy. Is that it? Advocartsy. Anyway, I've never had to say it before, and also Sotheby's and Roxanne Zand for their support of this program. So thank you, and Homan, you're next.
Okay. Hi. I'm here to tell you a little bit about what it means to be a collector. Sorry, my eyes are not what they used to be. The collector syndrome is a peculiar affliction. On the psychological spectrum, it lies somewhere between OCD, hoarding, sadomasochism, and narcissistic personality disorder. OCD because, well, you literally become obsessed with those things that you collect, their condition, their history, their provenance. Hoarding, well, that one's self-explanatory. Sadistic, because at some point you realize you've spent countless hours of your life picking up, putting down, lifting, hanging, packing, unpacking, framing, photographing, researching, and cataloging things that at times just start to look like a pile of colored, splattered paper and stretched fabric. Masochistic, because invariably you end up inducting your unwitting loved ones into a life of servitude to the very same Sisyphean tasks of a Stockholm syndrome to which you yourself have submitted willfully. And narcissistic, because like Snow White's Maleficent, you surround yourself with magic mirrors and battle till you have breath, obsessed with having the fairest collection of them all in the kingdom. A kingdom in which garage sales, estate sales, fortuitously unknowing antique dealers, and auction houses become your battlefields, and museum curators, gallery owners, and auction specialists become your therapists, your friends, and with a little bit of luck, your devoted spies. But the real peculiarity of the collector syndrome is that, unlike other psychological disorders, this one is a contagious condition that becomes particularly severe if you're genetically predisposed and proves incurable if, with your genetic predisposition, you connect up with a match which unleashes the peculiar mutation to push the afflicted into the severest ranges of the spectrum. My genetic predisposition is well known to those of you who know my parents, Nejat and Homa. I grew up in a home where some of the greatest poets, painters, novelists, playwrights, and intellectuals of 20th century Iran were frequent visitors and often guests at our dinner table. And of all the material objects in my parents' home today, one Sohrab Sepehri watercolor, two Hossein Mahjoubi oils on canvas, three Reza Moafi calligraphies, and five fine Persian rugs, which I consider part of the same category, are the only things that remain with us from our life before the revolution in Iran. But my case of the collector syndrome was only fully unleashed when I connected up with a match. In 1990, I started graduate school at Columbia University and went to work as one of the assistants for Professor Ehsani Yashater at Columbia University's Center for Iranian Studies. The following June, the center hosted the first of many galas to benefit the Encyclopedia Iranica, which had only published its second volume then. You'll see a 23-year-old me with Maryam Ansari and Masoud Nader, figures that many of you know. In our fundraising efforts, we thought it would be a nice idea to ask a few artists to donate works for a silent auction. While the response was greater than what any of us would have imagined. Within 6 months, over 120 Iranian artists from around the world sent in works, and the center was simply overwhelmed. So Dr. Yashater asked me exclusively to focus my efforts for the gala on the silent auction. The auction was a huge fundraising success, and to thank me for my help, after the gala, Dr. Yashater gave me one of the paintings as a gift. This oil on canvas by Hissam Abdishami is the first painting in my collection. Since many of the 120 pieces had not sold at the auction, I suggested to Dr. Yashater later that fall that we should organize an exhibition to sell as many of the works as we could to benefit the encyclopedia. And despite his initial resistance, he finally agreed, and I took advantage of my association with the French department to use the space in the Maison Française, usually reserved for lectures, to set up in November of 1991 a group exhibition of works by artists that included Parviz Tanavoli, Bahman Mohassis, Parviz Kalantari, Sadegh Tabrizi, Nasser Oveisi, Hossein Mahjoubi, Manoucher Yektai, and many, many others. The show was another success for the center. It also had an unanticipated effect in my personal life. I'm still not sure what happened, but word really got around very quickly about my connection to the Maison Française, and various people started to contact me to put a show for them at Columbia University. The first artist to approach me was Sadegh Tabrizi, for whom I curated a solo exhibition in spring of 1992. My agreement with him was that he would pay all of the expenses and I would do all of the work, and my fee would be one painting that we would pick together at the end of the show from among the ones that had not sold. He loved the idea and we proceeded, and this piece became the second piece in my collection. A few months later, in 1992, I organized another group exhibition at the Maison Française with the help of Ms. Janet Lazarian from Tehran, with the same agreement. And this work by Parviz Kalantari became the third piece in my collection, and by then, my fate was sealed. In 1993, I curated a solo exhibition for Nasser Oveisi in Soho, for which Mr. Oveisi gave me this beautiful piece as a gift, and then again in 1994, in the same space, another show for Mr. Oveisi, which resulted in this beautiful gift. By around the same time, Shirin Nishat had just entered the art scene with her first series of works, The Women of Allah. My mom reached out to me and asked me to seek her out and see if Shirin would be willing to show some of her photographs at a conference my mom was organizing for the Foundation for Women's Studies. I met Shirin in a coffee shop in the Lower East Side, and she gave me the photographs. And when I met her again to return them to them, she gave me this original piece as a gift. And that became the beginning of a very, very long and dear friendship. And over the course of the years, I begged her consistently and over again to please, please let me model for one of your photo shoots. And I finally succeeded. When she took this photograph of my feet for her series inspired after in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, with an inspiration from Mehdi Ahavan Salas's poem Faryad. You can read Khanam Atash Gereftast, Atashi Jansuz, and so on and so forth. Because of the work I had done for the Ironica Gala, I had also found the opportunity to meet the late Ardeshir Mohassis. Over the course of the following years, I would visit him frequently, not only to buy pieces for my own collection, but also to try and help sell his works to others. Purchased by my parents from Mr. Mohassis on one of these occasions in 1995, this work entitled My Dear Interrogator, and the top is cut off. Well, this work was produced after the murder of Ali Akbar Saidi Sijani in 1994 at the hands of the interrogators in the Islamic Republic prisons. This is a photograph of the three of us with him in 1993. A work that would later become a housewarming gift to me by them and a very cherished addition to my collection in 2013. Here you see another piece. This was a gift that Mr. Mohassis sent me one day in the mail, another one of his works in my collection. The genetic match I had found in Dr. Yashater was no ordinary match. I would eventually come to learn that he himself was a great collector, not just of articles that were comprising the Encyclopedia Iranica, but of medieval Persian ceramics, of manuscripts of Khayyam's Rubaiyat, the largest ever amassed at the time they went up for auction in the mid-90s, of fine Persian rugs, of exquisite English silver, and of modern Iranian art. And, as was always the case with Dr. Yashater, everything to which he exposed me would eventually turn into a life-altering shift of encyclopedic proportions for me in my life. and the impact would be so great that decades would have to pass before I could arrive at the vantage point required retrospectively to capture its full effect. But it wasn't just about that first gala for Ironica. In the midst of organizing all these exhibits, I also found his article on contemporary Iranian art in Highlights of Persian Art, an article that would prove pivotal in my life as a collector. It was the beginning of everything I know today about the Saqqakhane movement, in particular, and modern Iranian art in general, and the first step in a long road of personal research in a field that remains sadly understudied to this day. In there, I found the names of many of the pioneers of modern Iranian art, and that list became my first roadmap and the backbone to a 24-year standing discipline in my own personal curatorial eye. So by the time when a then stranger named Arya Iqbal cold called me from Tehran in 1996 to ask if I was interested in co-curating a show with her, the Maison Française, I had become firm enough in my conviction to recognize the call as an opportunity that I could not afford to pass up. I told her that I was too busy with my dissertation to do the show, but that I would be happy to use her help to acquire works that I knew I could never find outside of Tehran or Iran. 21 years later, not only has she become one of the dearest people in my life, but she is also the single most important force behind the collection that I have amassed to date. Together, Arya and I have built what I believe to be one of the more unique collections of 150-plus museum-quality works of modern Iranian art in private hands. Years before the internet and email, before AOL and dial-up modems, by phone and by snail mail, she presented me with selection after selection of some of the most breathtaking works from the pioneers of modern Iranian art, and with a student budget, I began to buy whatever I could. This work from Jazeh Tabatabai, 1978, Asp Nishaste Banuy Khaste. This work by Parviz Kalantari from 1968. And this work by Sadegh Tabrizi, one of his earliest works, and one of the works that eventually was part of the group of works that gave the name Saqqakhane to the movement, were the first three pieces I bought with her help, all, each one from the artist directly. So, to a person suffering from a full-blown collector's syndrome at this point, the knowledge I had acquired by then about modern Iranian art, combined with the access that Arya provided and the complete absence of competitors in the market, made for a perfect storm. For years, I lamented with selfish glee about why the rest of the world was so blind to the artistic value of these pioneers. And every time I thought about it, I prayed that everyone would stay asleep for just a bit longer. How else could I have afforded this Pilaram on a student budget? I later found out that this particular work was shown at the Galerie Cyrus in Paris. This is the opening night. You can see the work behind him. This is Pilaram. The queen and the king are attending the opening night, and I actually also found a digital copy of the actual exhibition catalog. This is where the OCD comes in, right? Or this one. Beautiful work on paper, tempura on paper, that was in one of his first shows at the Iran Hall, later Galerie Gandriz. And this particular piece was also shown at the inaugural exhibition of the Tomoka, the Tehran Museum of Modern Art, in 1977. Or this piece on paper by Hossein Zenderudi, which really has all of the characteristics of the Saqqakhane movement. That may be a lecture for another night. Eventually, the internet was starting to get more and more populated with information, and so I decided to take advantage of the opportunity. And one day I Googled Tanavoli. Like, what the heck? You know, who knows what's going to happen? I found an email address. I send an email address into the internet, And about 5 days later, Mr. Tanavoli replied with a list of 25 works, all available for sale. The most expensive one was about $15,000 back then. And the only one I could afford was this Heech. And even then, I was $350 short. So I did what, you know, any self-respecting addict does. I called home for an early birthday present. And my mom picked up the phone. She's like, well, your birthday's in 9 months. And you don't need another piece of art. You went there to get a PhD, so you need to start working. And then my father chimes in, you know, tell you what, I'll give you $500. You go buy another wall. You put the wall in your apartment. And after you have a new wall in your apartment, then maybe you can go and buy more works of art. But anyway, when the Heech finally arrived, because it wasn't signed, Mr. Tanavoli promised that he would come by and sign it for me. He had left all his stamps in Tehran. And eventually he kept his promise and came home and we had tea. And it's one of the pleasures of collecting. You really start to get to know a lot of these artists. Not always a good thing, but in my experience so far, it's been wonderful. I have about 6-7 more minutes. So, by 2004, the market was starting to pick up in Tehran and time was running out. Everyone had thought that the market was peaking, so more pieces started to come to the market as the owners were trying to capitalize on them before the perceived bubble burst. That year, I was finally able to purchase my first ever elusive Qandriz, this one from his sister's private collection. It's a very, very unusual Qandriz. Those of you who are familiar with his work know that he usually does not do figurative work. He did one series, and this one he always kept for himself, and eventually his sister got it, and I purchased it from her. And Mansour Qandriz, photographed here, you see him in this as one of his own shows at Talar Iran, was one of the founders of the Saqafane movement, and also one of the founders of Talar Iran, where this photograph was taken, which was later named Galeri Qandriz by his friends when he died in an unfortunate car accident in 1966 at the young age of 33, which means that there are not very many Qandrizes around, unfortunately. Over here, we have a more recent acquisition by Cyrus Malek. Cyrus Malek was also among the early Saqafane painters. In fact, he was the one who got the original lease for the Talar-e Iran. And that's, again, a story for another night. I don't have that much time, so we'll just flip through these as fast as we can. As I acquired more pieces, it became important for the criteria of my selection process to expand accordingly. I could no longer only concentrate on the Saqafane pieces, because by 2002, the collection had taken on a life of its own, and with it, I had morphed into more of a custodian than a simple collector. With this shift, I had also started to feel a new additional sense of responsibility to represent as much as possible the full breadth of modern Iranian art. So this piece by Masoud Arabshahi, an unusual Arabshahi, there are more in the collection, but you know, again, what do collectors, you want the typical and the atypical. So this is a typical Arabshahi. This beautiful piece by Jafar Ruhbakhsh from 1987. And this one of Parvan Etemadi's earliest works from about 1970. It's a work pastel on paper. We're just going to flip through some of these photographs now. Garnit Derhokopian, also one of the early members of the Qandriz Gallery, but after the revolution, Mr. Derhokopian decided to just stay home and lock himself up. And for about 35 years, he did nothing but produce work. And he was almost a forgotten name until last year. There was a retrospective of his work in Tehran, curated by Arya. And I really think, and when it comes to composition, he has no rivals among his peers. He's fantastic. This very, very early work by Hossein Kazemi has a very special place in my heart. This one here you see next to it is a work owned by Professor Yasha Ter. And it's actually a photograph that's in that article that I told you about. And when this one came up for auction, I mean, it was kind of a no-brainer. I had to own it, so it now lives with me. And this fantastic work by Siad Melkonyan, also one of the great artists of modern Iran, not part of the Savakhane movement. But when I saw this piece, I actually fell in love with it, and I didn't really know its history when I bought it. And again, part of the OCD research that one does after acquisition, I came to learn that this specific piece won the first prize in the first biennial in Tehran, and from there went to Paris because it won the selection, and in Paris also won the first prize at the Paris Biennale in 1958. You know, again, part of the pleasure of collecting is you actually get to meet some of these people and get to know who they are. Over here, a beautiful work by Mohsen Vazili Moghaddam. This is a picture of Mr. Vazili Moghaddam at the gala for the Iran Modern and Asia Society that took place in 2013. And we're almost done. But as any collector knows, even within our peculiar obsession, we all become particularly more obsessed with a few of the things that we collect more than the rest. I am no exception to this rule. Years before I even wrote the Iranica entry on Sohrab Sepehri, I was enthralled with him both as a poet and a painter. This beautiful work on paper is the first Sepehri that I bought for my collection. And later, this beautiful one from his famous trees collection. It's actually a very, very large piece. And you know, I it's kind of hard. I always stare at it. I always wonder whether he was a better poet or a better painter. I don't know. If you ask me today, I say maybe he was a better painter. It's a tough call. And in case you thought I didn't have any pictures with Sohrab Sepehri, you see me here with Sohrab Sepehri. My second obsession is with Reza Mafi, a master calligrapher and one of the pioneers of the Naqashi Khat school, which in many ways directly follows many of the tenets of the Saqahane school. So, just imagine what it felt like when, during my research for the Sepehri article, I came to learn that it was Reza Mafi who actually made the first tombstone for Sepehri's grave. And over here you have Besuragh Managar Miyayi, Narm Aheste Biyayi, Mabada Ke Tanak Bazarat, Chiniye Nazuke Tanhayi. I don't know, maybe he was a better poet. Photograph taken by my dear friend Abbas Hoja Tano. And another is Omafi. Oh, this one is actually the exhibition that Linda was telling you about. This one's going to be exhibited at the show. And the beautiful thing about this piece is on the surface, it just looks like a siyah mashq, right? What they do in the morning to get their hand going and getting warmed up. And once again, I had no idea what I was buying when I bought it. But after purchasing it, I realized that it was actually a coded message. And what it says is, I'm going to read it in Persian first and then translate for you. Ma dar zaman jashn haye be istilah 2500 sal shahanshahi Iran zindegi mikonim. In jashn ha moghei bargozar mishavad ke mardom bichare Iran dar nihayat faqr va gursnegi zindegi mikonan. Mashq Mafi Mordad Mah 1350 Shamsi. We live during the times of the celebrations of the 25th centennial of monarchy in Iran. These celebrations are taking place in Iran at a time when the poor people of Iran are dying of hunger and poverty. Mashq by Reza Mafi and the date. There is a lot to be said about the association of modern Iranian painting and work with poetry. It's an issue that not very many people have ever considered or talked about, but when they do, this would be a very good example of a painter, Mutahed painter. And we're almost done. Two more minutes. Among the contemporary artists, my dear late friend Sadegh Tir Afghan is one of the few who engaged in a dialogue with many of the aesthetics and principles of the Saqa Khani school, as you can see from this work here. Again, the combination of the writing, Linda was talking about that earlier, and in these two pieces that are actually part of LACMA's collection. And so when I was collecting all of these things, you know, a joke that was ongoing between my parents and myself, they always tell me, well, why are you buying all these? Where are you going to put all these things? And my response was, you know, I'm not going to stop until my house looks like Gertrude Stein's apartment in Paris. So, and this is the God's honest truth. When I was preparing this presentation, I Googled Gertrude Stein's apartment in Paris. And this is the photograph, right? The home of Gertrude Stein and Alice Vintokalis in the 6th Arrondissement small in Paris on the left bank. And this is a photograph of my last apartment in New York on 20th Street, you know, and it really, it was uncanny. I mean, almost the composition. You see the two lights here? You see the, I mean, it was just, so anyway, it kind of felt like, you know, one of these crazy things where you be careful what you wish for because, you know, it will happen. So thank you. Thank you, Linda, and thank you.
Hello, everybody. What a great privilege to be here tonight. Thank you to LACMA for inviting me, to Linda Komarov, to Roshi Rahnama of Advocacy for having me. Thank you, Linda, for your fascinating talk so that I learned so much about the exhibitions and the plans at LACMA. Thank you, Human, for making me understand what a good collection looks like. And also, you look uncannily like George Michael when you were young. So. Just to say very quickly, I'm going to do a lightning speed tour of a little bit of the historical background. I hope that what I have to say will be a little bit of a kind of balance to what's been discussed, and that I'll give a little bit, I don't know, a bit of a kind of geographic overview, a historical kind of context to what you've heard so far. Now, what I'm going to do is to start with a lightning speed a tour of some of the royal patrons in our region that remind us of what it means to have created royal patronage and the great glorious collections and, artifacts and art history that we know of. And then I'll talk about a few of the prominent art collectors today in the Middle East and what their case stories, because I personally find it's fascinating to listen to stories, as it has been to listen to Human's stories. Nothing is more fascinating than life stories and what people do. Then I'll talk very briefly about the art world landscape. In other words, how does everything fit like a jigsaw puzzle into what makes up our industry? And finally, very, very quickly, touch on the Middle East art market, but deliberately leaving out prices, investments, commerce aspect of it, just looking at why collecting is so important for our region, which is considered an emerging market, though it isn't really. So here, obviously, Shah Tahmasp, I think everybody in this room will have some reference point to the Safavid era. The Safavid era obviously gave birth to some of the most glorious works of art that we know, synonymous with the Chelsutun. This is a ruler who commissioned monuments, paintings, miniatures, carpets, manuscripts. And what he and his this fellow, who was in a sense his nemesis in Ottoman Turkey, what they had in common is that they gave so much, that so much art thrived at their court. And these monarchs would have ateliers where a number of artists at any given time would be engaged in They would be sort of painters, bookbinders, jewelers, goldsmiths. They would all be working at the same time. You know, for example, a calligrapher would be working on a manuscript at the same time as somebody would be illustrating for it. And, you know, great works of art were created during the Ottoman and Safavid eras. We come further along historically to the Qajar era. And of course, during the reign of Nasiruddin Shah, 50 years stability, he was himself a painter, a photographer. He loved photography. He really supported the arts and commissioned artwork. You know, commissioning and supporting artists in itself, in a sense, is an act of patriotism, but also a huge cultural benefaction. Then we come to the Empress Farah Pahlavi and the Pahlavi era. As you know, she was herself a trained architect. She was greatly interested in the arts and was very much responsible for the growth of the arts in Iran in the 70s. She was, along with Kamran Diba, responsible for Timoka, Tehran Museum of Art, Contemporary Art, and of course, Aga Khan, another sort of, if not a royal, but in a sense a royal, who has also been single-handedly, with his uncle, Prince Sadruddin. They have collected over 50 years and have now established a leading institution of Islamic and Iranian art in Toronto, the Aga Khan Museum of Art. They have amassed paintings, drawings, manuscripts, miniatures, etc., reflecting their Persian roots. We then go to the Gulf region, and of course you may or may not be familiar with Sheikh Saud bin Muhammad Al Thani, who was a very sort of eccentric, in a way, an eclectic collector. In a sense, as Humana has said, he was an obsessed collector. He collected anything from furniture, vintage cars, natural history, jewelry, watches, antiquities, bicycles, and purportedly spent about $1.5 billion on these collections. He was controversial. There was always a bit of a blurred line between what was his, what belonged to the state. But am I not using the microphone properly? Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay, thank you. So yes, he was. Thank you very much. A very controversial character, but then oversaw the development of five museums in Qatar, which of course is a momentous thing to have done. There is also his cousin Sheikh Mayasa Al Thani, who is the chairperson of the Qatar Museums Authority. She has also an annual budget of $1 billion, purportedly. She's said to have bought some of the most expensive paintings in the world, and she has, of course, been responsible for overseeing the opening of the IMP Museum, the Doha Museum of Islamic Art, quite a glorious institution. Then, looking further afield in the Arabian Gulf, the Arabian Peninsula, we look at Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. Obviously, Saudi Arabia, I haven't got a slide on them, but the Jameel family are very, very committed to the arts, development of the arts, and this a distinguished personage, Sheikh Hussa al-Sabah, has been the collector and founder of the Dar al-Athar al-Islamiyya, based around her private art collection, which is owned by herself and her husband, Sheikh Nasser. They bought their first object in 1975, and it started out as a hobby, but now they have a museum-quality collection, which will, of course, form the Kuwait National Museum's development, and they have about 24,000 objects representational of the Islamic world. Again, arms and armor, calligraphy, carpets, textiles, coins, glass, ivory. Anyway, a large number of categories. Now, going from royal to private individuals. Again, I'm just running through case studies simply because looking at these stories will give some indication of what a collection can be. And where does it start and where does it go to? The name of Nasser David Khalili is probably well known to most of you in the room. He has probably the finest or one of the finest Islamic art collections in private hands, about 25,000 works. He's published it in about 30 volumes. Again, he bought his first object at the age of 14. After college, he borrowed money to buy early pieces and got into dealing. Apparently, his collection is worth about $1.5 billion, but again, all of these figures have to be taken with a grain of salt. Within his collection, there are eight distinct collections, enamels, Meiji works of Japanese art, Swedish textiles, Spanish damascene, Islamic, and so on and so forth. So he has really done, he has really put together a great collection. From, I have to say, Muhammad and Maryam Masoudi are quite interesting because they are two of three generation of collectors. Senator Masoudi, Maryam's father, was one of the early great collectors, prominent collectors of Islamic art, and Maryam has continued his collecting practice. But then, of course, Muhammad, her son, has gone into much more sort of modern and contemporary collecting. He has about 400 pieces, 70 of which are on display in Dubai at his home, and some of which, I think about 25, are now on display at the Aga Khan Museum under the name of an exhibition called Rebel Jester Mystic Poet. He has started to actually expand into other areas beside Iranian. He buys Arabic art and Western contemporary. So they're an example of starting with an Islamic collection, for example, something that refers specifically to one's own legacy and heritage, and then developing and going into other arenas. There will be a book on the full collection later. Shafiq Gabr is an Egyptian collector. He started in 1993 with buying a painting by André Deutsch, and now he has the most prominent collection of Orientalist art, again in private hands. He also buys antique books. His collection is quite small, only 137 works, but quite an emotional one. He covers Egypt and North Africa, and he has himself said that what he wants to convey through his collection is an emotional message, coupled with his love of colors, textures, and local themes. Ramzi Dalul is, again, an interesting example. He's a Lebanese Palestinian. He has the largest collection of modern and contemporary Arab art in private hands. He has plans for a museum, but, again, only started to collect seriously 6 years ago. His first artwork purchased was on a business trip to Baghdad, and then he started to commission paintings. He befriended impoverished artists. He even supplied them with canvas and brushes. And he is known, actually, for his stock phrase, before I buy a work, I research it, which I think is probably good advice for all collectors. And one of the things that struck me by listening to Houman was really the wealth of knowledge, the bank of information that he draws upon. And this is absolutely essential because as collectors, you know, not collectors, even buyers or consumers of art, we look at something and we assume that we have a good eye, we have good taste, we understand what aesthetics is, and that's all very well. But collecting, really truly collecting, is a lot more than that. You need education, learning, research, and having a great deal of information about what you're doing. Ali Sarikhani's name may be less familiar to people here. He was actually trained as an accountant. He's a very well-to-do finance person in a way. He put together a collection that unveils the story of Persian art through a variety of art objects from the 3rd millennium BC to the 18th century. What's unique about his collection is that he houses it under his own home in Buckinghamshire. He's built a very state-of-the-art little museum. His collection is small, only about 250 pieces. But again, he has an extremely knowledgeable daughter who has studied history of art and Islamic art and helps him put together a most extraordinary collection that is very educational in itself. He did import 20 worksmen from Iran to create a replica of a mosque in Isfahan at the entry to his museum. So visiting his museum is actually quite an extraordinary experience and conveys something, again, which is typical of most collectors, a unique passion for what they do. Omer Kuch, like the Masoudis in a way, is one of three generations. He's the grandson of Vehbi Kuch and Sian of the Kuch dynasty. They've set up the first private museum in Turkey, the Sandberg Hanim Museum. They have one of the finest collections of Turkish and Islamic artworks, Isnik ceramics, archaeological artifacts. But most importantly and interestingly, and this is where you see a collector kind of expand their interests, Omer has the largest collection of artist self-portraits in private hands. And his house is quite extraordinary. It's quite spooky. When you go, it really is. Like Asuman was saying, it's absolutely plastered with artworks everywhere. You probably find artworks on the floor, under something, but it's just full of artist self-portraits and extraordinary objects and things. So fascinating, fascinating a place to visit. They are also philanthropists. They underwrite art fairs, biennales, and so forth, and that's also part of something that a lot of collectors who reach a certain stage do. It's to give back and to support the arts. Last but not least is Farhad Farjam, whose name may be familiar to you, Dubai-based originally. He has a collection which apparently approximately has 6,000 pieces. He bought his first work in 1973, which was a miniature, and his love of miniatures and his complete passion and obsession for collecting took him to Impressionists and Arab art and all sorts of other acquisitions, which reflect now a very diverse collecting interest. What I find actually about collecting, which is a common thread between the collectors, are, I would say, about four things. First, that all collectors remember the first thing they bought. Secondly, that the most loved item in their collection is not necessarily the most expensive item. Third, that the passion and excitement and the beauty of their collecting for them comes as a path of discovery. It's a journey, and it's the discoveries that give them pleasure. And maybe in Human's case, it's the pleasure of the chase also, because you have to find the item and pursue it and acquire it. And of course, the ultimate stage, the fourth, I would say, is that a lot of great collectors do become philanthropic. They do give back. They support the museums and institutions. And in this, I think I would say that it's a virtuous circle, because museums can't exist without art patrons and collectors. And art patrons and collectors can't exist without museums and institutions. I would challenge any collector to say that they didn't spend some time of their youth or childhood or learning experience not gazing at exhibitions, going through museums, benefiting from what the museums show us. Because don't forget that, as I was talking about the private collectors, and some of them have set up private museums, a private museum has no responsibility to the public. It only reflects the personal taste of the collector. But a museum or institution has a duty of being representational and historic. So when you go through a museum exhibition, the curator will have been very thoughtful. And I find that the most exciting and most accomplished curators are those that have the historical references. They have a wide and, historical, I suppose is the best word, understanding of what they're dealing with. So how does it all begin? Now, I've shown you slides of royal family members, extremely wealthy individuals, and you might say, well, how does this refer to me? Each one of you sitting in this audience today, how do I start to collect? Can I collect? My budget is $20,000 salary per year. In fact, Herbert and Dorothy Fogel, which you see the elderly couple there, are a supreme example. He was a postal office worker, and she was a librarian. He had a salary, I think, of $23,000 something, and they had zero money. I don't know if you know about them, and they are a very well-known couple. But for those who don't know about them, they started out just truly with their passion and understanding. Every day after work, they would trundle off to galleries. They befriended artists. They amassed through this path that they chose the most important post-1960s art collection, mostly minimal and conceptual, but they didn't really buy as investment. They just bought when they went on these gallery trips. All it had to be, the piece that they bought was something that they loved, that they could afford, which they sometimes paid in installments, but most importantly, that they could carry back home on a subway. So really and truly, there aren't any hard and fast rules for being a collector. Or being an art lover. The important thing is to attend, to participate, and to commit to loving art and being part of the art scene, if you like. By the time the Fogels died, by the way, they had donated 4,782 works to the National Gallery of Art, which just goes to say that you can start small and get big. The how-to of collecting is really, from my perspective, everybody has their own formula, and we have amongst us Human, who is a collector and can tell you more about that than I can, because I'm not a collector, I just work in that industry. The how-to of it, from my perspective, is first and foremost education. Now, you don't have to go to the Sotheby's Institute of Art. You can get educated about art in any number of ways. There are fine libraries, there are courses, there are all manners of ways of educating yourself. And for me, museums are the greatest education. My home was the Boston Museum of Fine Art and the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston when I was doing my education. The other thing, sorry, I think I have, I'm, all right. I wanted to tell you just a quick few words about the art world landscape. I should start really with a column on the right, the non-commercial, because in a sense what's important is, as part of this education, to attend biennales where artists explore, they experiment, you see art that is way out there, some of it is way over your head. You come away frustrated. Sometimes you don't understand what you've seen. But it's very important to be exposed to that, because that's the happening. That's what the, how to explain it, that's what is going through the artist's mind. Excuse me, I'm sorry. I'm really very good at messing this up. Excuse me. I'm sorry, Linda. I'm going to have to ask for your help. Forgive me. I seem to touch it at the wrong place. I just want to go back to the art landscape. Thank you. Thank you very much. The other thing is, of course, the other important source are the NGOs and foundations. They do something very important, which is that they represent usually what I call special interest groups. So it will be like, I don't know, Friends of the Iraqi Museums, or, you know, some aspect of a cultural group that needs support, that needs promotion. And, of course, the bedrock. From my perspective, the bedrock of everything are the museums and institutions, which offer generally free access to the public to educate themselves. To go to the right column, which is the primary market, again, the primary market is absolutely vital for our industry, because it's the dealers and collectors, and the primary market means the dealers and collectors. They're the ones who take the gamble, take the risk of promoting and showing new artists. And it's only once these galleries and dealers have helped artists launch themselves, acquire a following and an understanding of what they're doing, when they've had solo shows, when sometimes their work gets published, when, if they're lucky, a work is acquired by a museum, it's only then that they start to have some success in the secondary market, which is the part of the market that I represent. So the auction houses, really and truly, although sometimes we do try to be everything to everybody, and we have, for example, Sotheby's in 2008 had a show directly from Damien Hirst, and that, but that was an exception. We don't generally try to replicate the primary market. We sell artists that have already acquired a following. So if you look at the artists that we sell at Sotheby's, for example, in the Arab and Iranian sales that we have, they tend to be modern masters. We don't tend to have contemporary artists, new artists, emerging artists. And of course, art fairs are extremely important to attend. 54% of the art trade happens in art fairs. It's not, however, the fact that 54% of the trade takes place there. It's just that you get exposed to so much. Everything is under one roof. You go and you spend a couple of days and you see so much that's happening. In brief, to say the last few words, I have deliberately, as you see, avoided adding values, a sort of the prices of what these pieces sold for, but I've included them for a good reason, because the Fakhrinnisa Zayd, the Zayd painting that you see, the vertical one, sold for nearly £1 million, obviously a record, but the important thing is that it's going to be, Zayd is going to have a major retrospective at the Tate Modern in London. I urge anybody who's going to be in London to go see it. The Bahman Mohassis Omnibus Requiem was also an extraordinary work, which sold for a record price, similarly for the Nusha Tavakkulyan. And this is something that I should touch upon for those who enjoy the idea of collecting. One really good way of starting is to start in an affordable category, photographs or prints, and always try to buy the best of what your budget can afford. So if you're doing your research well, if you find, for example, a photographer like Nusha Tavakkulyan, if you explore her work, learn about her different series, find out which of those series you like, and then identify what you can afford, that's a really good way to go forward. And that's what's meant by doing your research. The work by Khosrow Jerdi was a fascinating work because this is an artist that had dropped out of the market, known as a modern master, and then suddenly comes back and is able to achieve a great price. Mahmoud Saeed, great Egyptian artist, portraitist, very, very popular and has done well. And Monif Arman Framayan obviously doesn't need any introduction, has had a retrospective. And it really, I have to say, all of these, what these pictures tell you, picture tells a thousand stories, as they say. What these pictures tell you is that the Middle East art market is right now at, how can I say, not at a peak, because that would suggest that it would go down, but it really is in a kind of renaissance. It's strong, it's doing well, there's growing interest in it, and it really is thrilling for me as somebody in the industry to be within the walls of a place that has the largest collection of Middle Eastern art in North America, and to be part of this discussion tonight. Thank you very much for your attention.
Hi, Linda, thank you so much for inviting me to participate tonight, and Houman and Roxanne, thank you both. I've learned so much this evening. I'm a little bit of an outlier here, so I'm going to try to make a case for myself as the evening progresses. I'm curator in the photography department here at LACMA, and my concentration is contemporary photography, and actually mostly American, and even more specific, really work that's being made in Los Angeles at this moment. The Department of Photography is really interesting because it has the opportunity to overlap with so many other departments in the museum, ones that are regional and ones that are also based in time-specific eras. So I get the opportunity to work with Linda and my colleagues in the Japanese department and contemporary and also modern. So I have that sort of singular ability to move about, and that excites me and interests me. One of the things that I do here at LACMA is I run a support group called Lens, and in that we visit artists who are working in Los Angeles with photography and video, so Lens-based artists working in town, and together we visit studios of these artists, and with the funds that the individuals give to be a part of the group, we buy a work by each person who we visit as part of LACMA's collection. So I'm going to take you through just four artists today whose work we have acquired through Lens. And what I want to say is that the action of visiting artists in their studios really translates across all artists, I think. The opportunity to sit with somebody, talk with them about what it is that they're making, gives you intuition into how to talk to any artist. So I think if any of you is interested in collecting contemporary art and working with artists, these are tools that you can acquire sort of from person to person. And so that's what I want to sort of suggest to you as we look at these works. These works in particular are about identity, and so I've chosen four artists whose work is looking at ideas about identity. So this is the work of John Houck, and he's an artist who is trained actually as an architect and as a computer programmer. And so he started making photographs by creating computer programs that would then yield images. And so oftentimes these look like graph paper and kind of linear images, because he wanted to think about all the different ways that an image could be created through mechanical means. And what you can see here is that he's using that kind of idea of the graph. He then, he's an artist who was actually raised on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. And as he was becoming a little bit older and his parents were getting a little bit older, they began to send him objects from his childhood. Simultaneously, he was going through Jungian analysis. And so these two things really were married in his mind. And so what he began to do was set up these still life photographs of these objects. And you can see one here, this medallion that was actually made for him when he was born. And he would say that his parents, both of them would send these objects to him independent of each other, and they would send them to him in totally different ways. That his mother would actually wrap them up in very secure and beautiful boxes. That's actually one of them there. And his father would just sort of stuff them in an envelope and send them to him. So this piece came to him from his mother, and so he laid it out and he made this photograph. And you can see how it's really unusual in the way that it's organized, because what he's done is he's printed out that photograph and then used it as a backdrop. And then upon that, he then laid out these objects again. And so it's really disorienting. You can't see from where the light source is coming, and you can't really understand what's up and what's down. And I think that's something that he was reconciling with at the time, among these objects, going through psychoanalysis, and then trying to make an image of them. So, as I said, this work is sort of about identity and the relationship of identity to objects and things. This is another piece by John Houck. He, as I said, was trained as an architect, and these are the tools that his grandfather had given him as a young person. And they, too, are photographed in a similar way in that they are... Oh, and there's the graph paper, too, that becomes some kind of a code for his way of working. And so there they are arranged, re-photographed, and then put up against that backdrop. So you have, again, this weird, unusual, strange relationship to these things. This is the work of Heather Rasmussen, and her investigation with identity has to do with her own body. She was actually trained as a dancer, and this object that you're looking at is a photograph of her foot on point when she was kind of at the peak of her dancing. Her apartment burned down, and everything, almost everything within it was ruined except for this singular object that remained. And so she became really intrigued by it and re-enamored with the idea of what it meant to her. She had given up dancing for photography, so these two things were sort of in kind of competition with each other. And she decided that what she wanted to do is to get back into dancing so that she could get her left foot into the same shape as this right foot of hers on point, and then be able to make a photograph. Here she is sort of in a performance with that foot mold. You see both her hands and her feet working in this kind of style of creating these images around this mold here. And this is the piece that we acquired for LACMA, this gridded piece. And she's really interested in setting up these situations for the camera. So she doesn't work with somebody who is photographing her. She's actually holding the shutter herself and making these images that then she shoots and makes into a photograph. This is a more recent piece, and she tends to use mirrors to kind of reflect parts of her own body. And there, as you can see, they start to become very complicated. And this one as well, this is actually from a show she has right up now at Acme Gallery. And so she's manipulating the mirror and reflecting part of her own body. She's holding the shutter, and she's using a 4x5 camera. So she's doing this all and kind of thinking about how it might then reveal itself in the mirror and then the photograph. She often includes bits from her garden, so these gourds and sometimes other squashes are included too. So it's a little bit of reach out into the landscape and kind of that iconography of the place in which she lives. And also, they are about kind of aging too, when you look at the way that that foot is created in the mold, and then the way that her body has changed over time. So she's also interested in, and also sometimes these fruits are not at their best, so they're kind of aging simultaneously. So it's sort of about the cycle of life and this relationship she has to her own body. This is the work of Anthony Lepore, and for him, identity is about working with within his own personal space. This piece is called The Boss. This is a photograph of his father. And his father owns a bikini factory in Los Angeles, has since the mid-1980s. And Anthony grew up kind of participating and being a part of this world and of this scene. When he graduated with his MFA, he moved back to Los Angeles. And he asked his father if he could have part of the factory as his studio. And so what he ended up doing was taking out two rows in the middle of the factory and building a studio inside of it. So it was literally four walls with no ceiling and a door. So as he's working in that space, he's surrounded by people who are cutting material, people who are sewing, and kind of the chatter of all of that around him. And so what he ended up doing was really being engaged with those materials that surrounded him. This is the piece that we acquired for LACMA's collection. And it is, again, and I say again because it's sort of similar to Heather's piece in that it's this reflection of this really kind of plasticky material that you can imagine what a small bikini might be made out of, and then the cleaning that's happening around it. And this is another piece from that series. So he doesn't work with Photoshop at all. Everything is in camera, and he sets it up for the purpose of making it into a photograph. And they're often very sculptural. They have this feeling of figures and hands and scissors and things that are really active inside that space. And I've had the opportunity to visit him there, and he suggested that I come maybe at 4 or 5 when the factory was done for the day, but I wasn't able to, so I came in the middle of the day. And actually, it was really difficult for us to even have a conversation in the space because we're elevated volume of the entire space, but you could really feel what that meant. And so I think that that atmosphere really has a way of kind of penetrating the work of his. And finally, this is a work by Jennifer West, and she's exploring identity and the landscape. And this is a piece that we brought into the collection, and it's made actually in the tar pits. And she's an experimental filmmaker who's interested in the physicality of the film. And so she often develops it in a variety of different materials, like pickle juice or ketchup or mayonnaise. And then she takes that film and she kind of physically attacks it as well. So sometimes she rolls across it with a motorcycle, or she scratches it, or she hits it with a hammer, etc. So those two things combined create these really expressive and amazing images. Here she is standing beyond the tar pits holding the film itself. And she said, actually, after she dipped it in the tar, and she did this kind of illegally. She did it in one of the seeps, not the main one, but you know the seeps that are kind of around, and people are scared to touch. Well, she just went in there and put the film in there, and then pulled it out. But then really had a hard time getting the tar off the film. So then she ended up using all kinds of acetate and nail polish remover, and it really attacked the surface in a way that I think is kind of thrilling and amazing, and very much about that place. She is from Southern California. And this place is very meaningful to her, and also its adjacency to the museum itself. And that's that final image. And this was on view. You might have seen that it was on view in the Stark Bar. So that's what we do through the Lens Group. And we've been together now for we've ended our fourth year here. And it's really interesting for me. A huge part of my job here at the museum is to go and do studio visits. And I do probably about 35 a year, so you know, one every week and a half, and it's a real joy and pleasure, as everybody has been saying, to meet the artists and talk to them and have that opportunity to really understand what it is they're making and why they're doing it and what about it is personal to them, and then what about it sort of speaks to a larger art history and art historical references. So I hope some of those ideas might translate to you as collectors. Thank you.